Hey everyone, welcome to Colored Red. Sorry about the little bit of a wait. I did end up spending a little bit more time reading about this case, and I got a little sidetracked with work, and we're back on track, and I hope to be back into the regular schedule of the every other Friday recording as soon as I can. So I have a really interesting story for you guys today. This is a story about a man who, when reading about him, seems too unbelievable to be real. His existence is a series of lies and excuses and cons that he seems to fight with himself over constantly. Reading any kind of interview done with him is completely exhausting just because he likes to talk and because a woman actually witnessed his crimes and escaped with her life. We have a twisted and dark tale. His murder rampage was thankfully short-lived, but he occasionally hints at having other victims. So this is the story of Denver Axe murderer William Lee Neal. William Lee Neal murdered three women with an axe inside of a Lakewood, Colorado condominium during the span of a week in July 1998. The survivor of the ordeal was named Suzanne Scott, and she was strapped spread eagle to a bed on her back and watched helplessly as the final woman of Neal's killing spree was murdered. She was left tied to a bed in a room with three dead women while her mind raced about what her fate might be. William Lee Neal was a seducer and a con man who liked to throw around cash on limousines and large tips, and who could wrap women around his finger easily, despite being unattractive and incredibly controlling. He managed to weave tall tales and stories about himself as an Army Ranger, as a bounty hunter, as a man who worked for the mafia, and as a very successful business owner and millionaire. He would tell these stories to anyone who would listen in seedy Denver and Lakewood area bars, earning him a nickname that he quite possibly made up for himself, called Wild Bill Cody. The information that I'll be providing today is largely from a book by Steve Jackson called Love Me to Death. Steve Jackson has written a number of books about Colorado murders that are all awesome if you want to check out anything else that he has written. I'll undoubtedly be using most of his books for future episodes. Additionally, everyone who knows me knows that I curse a lot. In fact, not doing it on the show has been a challenge. And I'm not concerned about it, but just in case anyone out there is, this show is going to feature some of William Lee Neal's colorful phrases and language, so just a heads up. Neal's childhood was surprisingly simplistic, according to his siblings, despite his own stories about it. Instead of being abused or having neglectful parents who left him alone, he had a normal childhood, punctuated by some overprotective tendencies from his mother, who treated him like a baby of the family who could do no wrong. His father was in the Air Force, but was secretive and aloof. Neal claimed that his father occasionally laid a hand to him and his siblings, but that it wasn't anything he couldn't handle. His siblings described him as the baby of the family, and Neal himself indicated that he had been molested when he was a teenager by an older woman who was married, and it forever soured his perspective on women and his relationships with them. He also claimed to have been molested by a priest and molested by a sergeant while Neal was serving in the army, which is what cut his service short. To read everything about Neal and hearing the story I'm about to tell, you might come to think that Neal loved excuses, even if he had to invent them, to cover up his own inadequacies. We can't be entirely sure about what Neal says about himself because we can't be entirely sure about anything he says at all, and you'll soon find out why. A lot like Edmund Kemper and a lot like Henry Lee Lucas, Neal loved to talk. He talked back and forth with himself for hours during his eventual confession, and we can get an idea of what has been stretched pretty far by him, from his sisters and siblings occasionally dispelling some of these untruths. We do know that Neal was married at least four times in his life prior to being arrested for murder. One of his wives, Karen Wilson, remembers Neal spotting her at the sporting goods store where she worked. After a brief exchange, she was smitten with his rugged simplicity, blonde hair, bright blue eyes, and ability to say exactly what any woman wanted to hear. After their encounter at her store, he came in the next day, and he was in a three-piece suit. He took her out to a picnic lunch, and he set up underneath a tree, and he gifted her with a sterling silver necklace only a day after meeting her. She was hooked by his romantic gestures and ability to quote famous novels or talk endlessly about topics he seemed to know anything about. They quickly became an item, and she would be treated to roses and bubble baths, dinners out at the most expensive restaurants in Washington, D.C., and limousine rides out to wild parties where he would toss around money. He told her and her parents that he had been in the Green Berets, was a successful tech company owner and philanthropist, and he made an impression as a wealthy man. But just as soon as their relationship started to pick up, it was only a couple months before Neil was leaving for long stretches at a time. Neil told her that he ran security systems businesses and had even installed a security system in the White House, so she expected him to be away on business but started to grow suspicious of the increasingly long trips. However, Karen was able to ignore a lot of the red flags for a while because it wasn't only the big stories that swept her away. It was the people that Neil seemed to know and who seemed to know him. Once when they went out hiking together through the woods, they came across a beautiful log cabin. Neil knocked on the door, and the couple who answered were delighted to see him and treated him like a long-lost son, offering them dinner. Situations like these sprang up around Neil all the time, but soon the romance and impressive adventures started to become clouded by his unfavorable tendencies. Neil had this weird habit of eyeing women in public who wore short skirts or what he considered to be skimpy outfits and muttering slut and whore under his breath as they passed. Eventually the comments got louder until Karen Wilson became embarrassed that the women might hear him and asked him to stop. Asking him to stop was the wrong move with William Lee Neil. No one was going to tell him what to do or control him. He started having outbursts of rage, and at around this time in their relationship, Neil's tests of his wife Karen began to take shape. He brought her to a cabin in the woods to fulfill a fantasy, as he called it, and while she was expecting a romantic weekend, he called another man up to have a threesome, which she declined. After she declined, he congratulated her on her passing his test, one of many that would come up in the next couple of years. They eventually married, despite all of this, and he started to play a game where he would reveal a deep, dark secret of his, then ask her to reveal one of hers. If she said anything about a past relationship with another man, he would fly off the handle. Once she told him she accidentally slept with a man in her past who was married, Neil pinned her to the ground and made her promise to call the wife of the other man years later and let her know this. He would attack her like this several more times, often pinning her against the wall by her throat, and always making her feel like it was her fault that he had attacked her. His controlling only got worse. If she was a couple minutes late from work, he'd want to know who she'd been fucking, in his words. Break any of his rules, go out with friends, go out on an unexpected errand, make calls to people he didn't know, and there was hell to pay. He could come and go as he pleased, eye women, grab women, stay out all night drinking, but she better be at home. He would get envelopes in the mail with pairs of used panties and pictures of nude women in them all the time, and this was something that Karen had to get used to. Neil morphed into, for lack of a better term, more obvious and outward dick towards people. He no longer cared about convincing anyone, especially Karen, that he was respectful or romantic. He would complain at restaurants to get free food. He would get testy with waitresses and call them lewd names. Eventually, he got tired of D.C. and moved Karen to Texas, where she stayed in an apartment with him. Their sex started to get rough and aggressive, according to her, and there was no romance there anymore. It was shortly after they moved to Texas that he said he had to go help his mother move from her home, and Karen figured he might be gone a couple of weeks, maybe even a month. But 1 month became three, and Neil still didn't show back up. What's more is he seemed to know a lot about her daily life, despite not being there. He somehow knew when she answered the door with a beer in her hands. He knew if she was out or coming home late by even a few minutes, and he would begin blowing up the phone the second she was supposed to arrive home. Later she discovered that the elderly neighbor couple across the hall had been hired by Neil to spy on her and keep a logbook of her comings and goings. Neil didn't end up returning from helping out his mother for 8 months. When he returned, he asked her for a divorce and then immediately begged forgiveness and promised they would make it work. What Neil was actually doing during those 8 months is really anyone's guess. Soon after this, Karen returned home from work one day to find that Neil had sold all of their belongings, which were actually mostly hers. She had wanted to live a free and minimal life for a long time, so she went along with it for a bit. He had plans for them to travel the world and live only out of a suitcase, something she had always dreamed of doing. For the time being, they moved into a van in front of one of his friend's houses, and she continued to work as a secretary for a nice office while he slept in the van all day. He refused to let her go into the house to change and shower in the event that she was somehow seen by the guy who lived in the house, so she had to get ready in business casual attire for work in the cramped van. Months went by like this, and her savings was gradually eliminated by his spending. It became clear to her when she received divorce papers filed months before, when they originally moved, that he had no intention at all of starting fresh with her or traveling the world. He had sold everything she owned and pocketed the money, stripped her of all her friends and family and finances until she was utterly alone and destitute. He let her know, when she agreed to divorce, that from that moment out, he was going to fuck over every woman in his path because to him, women were nothing but a bunch of whores. Karen Wilson divorced William Lee Neal and thought she was done with him. But he wasn't done with her. Over the years following the divorce in 1985, she would get calls from him no matter where she was, what her last name was, or how much she tried to restrict her phone number. He had a knack for finding her. Sometimes he would talk and she would humor him and listen while he told her stories, in between begging for money. Neal tried various tactics to get money out of her, including telling her he needed it to pay off the mob to get a hit off of him. He called when his mother died, and he called one last time when he was in the middle of a divorce from his fourth wife, saying he needed money for the court costs, which she declined. For Karen Wilson, she luckily escaped her ordeal with Neal with her life. One of the last things he told her was that he was hanging out a lot in Denver, and he was calling himself Wild Bill Cody. If you're unfamiliar with Old West history, William Cody, aka Buffalo Bill Cody, was a Western showman, scout, and soldier. He served with the Union Army during the Civil War, ran a Wild West show during the Chicago World's Fair that famously held the serial killer H.H. Holmes, and he traveled the world as the character Buffalo Bill and became a figure of the Wild West. His grave is at Lookout Mountain in Golden, Colorado, which is just outside of Denver. He received the Medal of Honor for his civilian scouting during the Indian Wars. So why William Lee Neal would compare himself to him is anyone's guess, but we'll soon see how William Lee Neal thought he was a much bigger man than he actually was. Neal's fourth wife, Jennifer, was only 18 years old when they married, and she was a topless dancer. On the night he asked her out, he laid out $1,000 in $1 bills. Jennifer Tate didn't like her profession and always imagined herself as a wife and mother. Neal knew all the right things to say to her to sweep her off of her feet. He tossed around cash and bought luxurious meals. Yet when he brought her back to his apartment, she was shocked to see how it was a tiny, run-down place with ratty, mismatched furniture. It looked like he had just tossed it in there. He wanted her to feel at home, but there was one rule. She could never enter a closet that he had that was closed and locked. He told her that he had been a member of the elite Airborne Rangers, and she figured there might be guns in the closet. Their relationship continued on, despite the fact that she had used birth control and wore condoms. She was soon pregnant and living full-time in his apartment. The same pattern of controlling began, just as it had with Karen Wilson. Jennifer went out one night to eat with a gay friend from the club and came home to find all her items in garbage bags because Neal was kicking her out. He didn't like gays, he said, or blacks or Hispanics. He screamed that he had been molested as a child by a priest, a topic that he managed to simultaneously seem reserved about, but eager to tell anyone who he wanted to gain control of, and to catch people off guard. So 2 months pregnant, Jennifer moved into her mother's house before he called to apologize and get her back with him. He started using his work office as a punishment zone, where he would tie her to a chair and question her for hours. He liked to use the phrase, "you don't know the meaning of scared," quite a lot. Their activities, or rather, the activities that he wanted to do, and consisted of watching porn, going to bars where Jennifer couldn't drink on account she was pregnant, and going to the Stampede, a country western dancing bar, where Neal would throw dollar bills off the balcony and laugh as people scrambled to pick them up. He would also grope waitresses in full view of her, then become enraged if she even looked in the direction of or exchanged any words with a man, calling her a slut and a whore every chance he got. She was obviously not dancing any longer, and she was given a weekly allowance, but wasn't allowed to grocery shop on her own, cook meals, or leave the house without him as a chaperone. If she broke these rules, they went into his office, the punishment zone, where he would strap her down and yell at her. He often came home drunk at 3 a.m. and accused her of sleeping around. When she went into labor, he refused to take her to the hospital. Her mother drove her, and Neal showed up several hours later, heard she hadn't given birth yet, and then went to a local bar and didn't show back up until the next morning after she had already given birth. He then took them home and left again for a couple of days. Their daughter became another bargaining chip for Neal, and he would always threaten to take her away if she crossed him. One evening, almost exactly the same way he tricked Karen Wilson, Neal took Jennifer to a local swingers motel. I looked into what this motel was, and I think it still exists. If it's the same one, it's on Colfax, and it's called Mon Chalet. According to their website, they have strict rules of conduct, all of which Neil broke that night, and this has nothing to do with the hotel itself. He brought Jennifer into the common clothing optional pool area, and curiously, when she told him that she had been groped by another man, he wasn't at all concerned. When they got back to the room, Neil tied her up and blindfolded her. It was then that she heard the sound of the door opening and then felt another man on her. She screamed, and the man left, saying that he was sorry and that he thought it was okay. They left the hotel, and the next day, Neil kicked her out of the house with their baby. After this, she started to become suspicious that Neil was groping their daughter after the baby had become fearful of baths after a night that the daughter was home and being bathed by him. Jennifer told one of Neil's sisters, and she informed Jennifer to be careful because Neil had been under suspicion at one point in a case from New York in the 1980s where a girl was abducted from a gas station, raped, and killed. Shortly before Thanksgiving 1994, Jennifer had been left for 3 days in the apartment with no food or diapers. Neil finally called, and she could hear that he was with another woman, and she yelled at him to not forget to wear a condom. This was a mistake, and he flew into a rage and said he was coming home. She called the cops, who escorted her to her mother's. He later called and apologized, as he always did, and asked her to come home and go to dinner with him and his mother. She went to dinner but stayed with her mom. During the back and forth that Jennifer did between her mom's and their apartment, Neil always seemed to know where Jennifer was and what she was doing. Once her sister had been kissed by a man as they were walking down the street without Neil, and he confronted her later about it, thinking that it was her, an indication that he was following her. She eventually moved back in, and as a show of good faith, he let her look into the locked closet. She said it was filled with army duffel bags and pictures of nude women. What the bags contained was unknown. Around the time this was unfolding, Neil had been caught for embezzling $70,000 from the security systems company where he worked, and he was forced to abandon his shares and leave the company. Neil filed for divorce from Jennifer Tate in March of 1996, and Jennifer was the last girl to escape William Lee Neil before the worst began. William Lee Neil, or Wild Bill Cody, was now in full swing in the Denver bar scene. He strutted around in a black Stetson cowboy hat, black t-shirt, floor-length black duster coat, and Wrangler jeans. His hair was also dyed black. He told wild tales and tossed around cash, often tipping well over 100% on his bar tabs. But where exactly he got this cash would be revealed in time. Rebecca Holberton had just divorced a couple years prior to meeting Neil at a party. Neil wasn't particularly physically attractive to her, with his gut, his long hair beneath his Stetson, and his arrogant way of talking, but he immediately listened, and he was eager to please her. He offered her a lot of things, like helping to fix her finances and help with remodeling her house. He moved around money in front of her despite actually being over $50,000 in debt after his relationship and divorce from Jennifer Tate. He alluded that his money came from the mob and told people in bars that he was a hitman. He told everyone he had been in the Airborne Rangers and always wore his long duster around to add to his air of mystery and wealth. He moved in with Rebecca only after being with her for a few weeks, and Neil managed to talk Rebecca Holberton out of a lot of her money over the matter of a couple of months, somehow managing to borrow $60,000 from her, with the promise that a big trust was opening up for him soon, and she would have the money back and then some. Not long after he moved in, he put up butcher paper on the inside of the windows of her Lakewood townhome, as if to prepare the interior for painting. The paper would not be coming down until all was said and done. One morning, Neil excitedly told Rebecca that his trust had opened up and that she could write herself a big check from his checkbook covering the cost of the entire $60,000 that had been borrowed. He also promised her a vacation and anything else her heart desired. He sat her in a chair in the living room of her townhome, and he placed a large suitcase on her lap, which had been filled with newspapers to add to the weight and drama of it. He popped a bottle of champagne and poured each of them a glass. Then he told her he had a surprise. He covered her head in a blanket so that she couldn't see his surprise. That morning, he had already been to a building supply store where he bought lava soap, duct tape, 4 large eye bolts, and a bit of rope, and a splitting maul. Now, he stood behind the blanket-covered head of Rebecca Holberton, who had sipped her champagne and sat in excited anticipation for a surprise that Neil was going to show her. Neil left the room and re-entered with the maul in hand. He swiftly brought it down over the back of her skull. She threw her hands up to the wound instinctively as he chopped her hands too, as he continued to deal blows to her head. When he was through, he noticed a piece of skull and hair had flown across the room and landed on the floor. He picked up the bone with a used ice cream sandwich wrapper and took it to the kitchen. He then wrapped Rebecca's body like a mummy in a blanket and garbage bags and left it to sit in her townhome. He then left to go cruise the bars. It was at a hotel bar where Candace Walters worked and where Neil first saw her. She was older than most of the women he had been with at 48 years old, and Candace Walters had already been divorced and was sworn off men until she met William Lee Neal. She and her daughter Holly were extremely close and lived near each other. They would go on walks and talk every day, sometimes multiple times a day. Holly was suspicious of Neal and all his boasting, but it was the happiest she had seen her mother in a long time. Candace was also suspicious, but she said Neal made her laugh and that she was happy again when she was with him. She became even more suspicious as Neal began telling her that he was going to buy her a mansion next to his in Las Vegas. One day, he even brought over a binder full of pictures of a Las Vegas mansion, as well as pictures of a mansion that he said was going to be hers. She would also be getting a new car and anything else her heart desired. Like Rebecca, Candace loaned Neal money constantly. He often used the story that he was trying to get custody of his daughter, and with tears in his eyes would beg for money to cover court costs to get his baby girl back. He promised that she would be paid back and then some, just as soon as the trust he had was unfrozen. Then, one day, in a flurry of excitement, Neal showed up to let her know that the trust was unfrozen. He wanted her to move with him to Las Vegas where she would get everything she needed. He wasn't just going to be paying her back her money. She would be getting a couple $1 million. There was only one condition. She couldn't tell anyone about any of it, not even her daughter. She was growing suspicious of all the money talk, and one day while she was sitting in his car waiting for him to get out of the bank, she peeped at the car registration. It was registered to a woman named Rebecca Holberton. Candace told her daughter about all this, and Holly had a gut feeling that something was wrong. Neal told Candace there was a job waiting for her with his business in Vegas, and she began to finally feel like this was all true. She sold her car in anticipation of the move and was told by an excited Neal that he had a big surprise for her. Shortly before the big surprise, Holly went to her mother's home and was greeted with a big hug by Neal, who only the day before had bashed in the skull of Rebecca Holberton. Later, Holly said goodbye to her mother and left on a business trip. Candace had been antsy and nervous in anticipation of all the big changes, and she was still thinking that Neal was a part of the mob, and the mob was somehow listening to her in her conversations. Nevertheless, Holly left, and Candace got ready in a white sundress and did her hair. Neal picked her up to take her to his place for the big surprise. She was shocked upon entering because the floors were plywood. There were dirty dishes stacked everywhere, as well as fast food bags and piles. He sat her down in a single chair in the living room and asked to put a blanket over her head. She declined, stating that she didn't want to mess up her hair. He put the blanket around her shoulders instead and placed a large briefcase on her lap and told her it was full of money. Then he made her promise to keep her eyes closed. He left the room and came back with his maul, lifted it, and struck it down on her head from behind. He continued to bring it down until he was satisfied. Then, in one final act against Candace, Neal urinated on her body and wrapped her head in a plastic bag, then drug her over to the fireplace and put a blanket over her. He then moved a mattress into the room and screwed the four eye bolts into the corner on the floor around the mattress, tied ropes to them, and went back out to drink. Suzanne Scott knew Neal from the bar that she and Beth Weeks worked at, where Neal could be found from noon to closing on most days. Like with every other woman, Neal claimed he was a hitman and a millionaire and tossed around money like it was nothing. He showed the women pictures of a mansion in Las Vegas that he said was his, and in the months leading up to June and July 1998, he played the con game just as he had with Rebecca Holberton and Candace Walters. He took the women on lavish dates out on the town and rented limousines for most occasions. Neal was supposedly Beth Week's boyfriend, but nothing was serious because in June, Neal asked Suzanne Scott if she could come work for his mortgage lending business. He wanted to take Suzanne to Las Vegas with him, and she agreed to go check it out just to see if it was for real. But she had to promise Neal that she wouldn't tell anyone about the offer, especially Beth Weeks. 2 days before the trip, on July 3rd, Neil told Suzanne and Beth that he wanted to take them out, and they figured that he'd want to go to Central City, a gambling town near Denver, for a night of fun. The women waited at a local pizza joint and were surprised to see Neil walk up, drinking shooters, come in, drop to one knee, and propose to Beth Weeks. They considered it to be a joke. Then he took them to the Diamond Cabaret, a strip club with steak dinners, followed by a night of bar hopping, some local haunts, where Neil took Candace Walter's debit card to various ATMs and used $1,000 stolen from Rebecca Holberton to pay for drinks and big tips. He had killed Candace only 8 hours prior. The group then went to the Stampede, where Neil lectured young men sitting around them on how to properly treat women at a bar by standing up when they entered the area to sit down. Suzanne Scott got back to her place on Sunday, July 5th, and prepared for her and Neil's trip to Las Vegas. He picked her up at 7 p.m. and told her that he had something to pick up at his place. He brought her into the townhome and wrapped a piece of cloth around her eyes and duct-taped her mouth, somehow convincing her that that was how he was going to be surprising Beth Weeks later, and that he wanted to do a dry run on her to see how it went. Neil guided her into the house, and she could immediately tell that the floors were unfinished plywood. He had her sit down, but she went down further than she expected and landed on a mattress. It was then that he tied her arms and ankles with the ropes on the eye bolts and removed her blindfold. She began to cry as she understood everything that had been a lie. He opened her blouse and asked her if she had seen a human skull. She said no, and he brought something wrapped in paper over to her. Then he placed a bloody chunk of skull with hair still tangled onto it onto her bare stomach while she was tied down. With this on her stomach, he now went around the room, past a body wrapped like a mummy in plastic bags, to a blanket that he lifted up to show Suzanne the legs of Candace Walters. It was then that she felt sure she would die, because she didn't know why he would show her this and let her live. She heard a banging sound, like someone in a nearby room, and Neil told her that his friends were upstairs and she would be sorry if they were disturbed. He then turned on some country music videos for her entertainment and left her there, strapped to the bed in his den of horrors, with the bodies of two women in the room, while he went out to search for his next victim. Angela Feit had been in a bad relationship with her ex-husband, who had a history of beating her. She had children with him in an attempt to bring them closer and end the abuse, but it only made things worse. After divorcing her husband, she got a job at a bar called Fugly's in Lakewood, Colorado, where she met William Lee Neal. She had met her share of creepy men while bartending there, including one who seemed to stalk her, but she thought she finally found someone she could trust in Neal. Neal treated her to nights out and was especially good to her two children, often bringing them gifts. Angela Neal and Beth Weeks had all known each other through their bar hopping, and Angela had met Suzanne Scott as well. Angela also hung around with her sister Tara, who was immediately off-put by Neil and thought he was a liar. Tara had been at a gym working out the week of July 1998 that Neil was supposed to be in Las Vegas and called a friend to let her know that Neil was watching her from the parking lot. Why would he be out there if he was supposed to be in Vegas? And why was he following her? Neil didn't like Tara's ability to see right through him, and he especially didn't like how Angela, her sister, was beginning to question him as well. Angela questioned whether or not he was married, because he only ever wanted to see her on weekends. Angela Feit came home one evening to find that someone had gotten into her apartment through a window, and curiously enough, they had neatly arranged her shoes by the front door. As Angela was beginning to grow weary of Neil and his nonsense, she also secretly enjoyed his attention and promises. It was around this time, the weekend of July 4th, 1998, that Angela happily told her mother that Neil had a big surprise for her. The next day, after going to a Lakewood bar, Neil drove Angela to the townhome. He brought her in blindfolded and asked her to sit in a chair, taping her legs and arms to the chair so that she couldn't free herself. He then asked her how her day was going and removed the blindfold. She found herself sitting in a dirty, cluttered hovel. She sat near a blanket-covered mattress with a lump on it, and she could see a plastic-wrapped shape of a human in the corner. "Welcome to my mortuary," Neil said to her. At this time, he removed the blanket from Suzanne Scott, who was still strapped to the mattress, Angela looked at her and said, "I'm sorry, but we're not going to get out of here alive, are we?" Suzanne couldn't respond because of the duct tape over her mouth. Neil offered Angela a cigarette, which she smoked while her hands were still strapped to the chair. Then he exited the room to the kitchen and returned with his maul. In full view of Suzanne Scott, he plunged the maul into Angela's head from behind. Her body fell to the side, still chafed to the chair, and he hit her several more times in the head. He then left the room and came back without the maul, picking up the discarded cigarette next to Angela's body, and sat on the mattress to smoke it and survey his work. Suzanne Scott could hear the blood gushing from Angela like water pouring onto hard wood. Neil then got a blanket and wrapped it around Angela's head so that Suzanne, quote, didn't have to hear that. Then sat down next to Suzanne again on the mattress, and then Neil said, "You see how calm and smooth I am? Bet you didn't know that was coming." At this point, unfortunately, the ordeal was far from over for Suzanne. He untied one of her hands and, with a gun pointed at her, made her jerk him off. Then, when he got tired of that, and with the gun still pointed at her, he untied the rest of her and made her give him oral sex while she kneeled next to the still bleeding body of Angela Fite. What happens next is nothing short of genius on the part of Suzanne, and demonstrates her ability to remain calm and think quickly, even after witnessing what she had. Neil sat next to her and turned on the TV, and at this point she asked him to hold her hand and played coy. They lay there for a while with Neil still holding the gun, and later Suzanne would say that she made him hold her hand so that if she somehow fell asleep, she would know if he got up so he couldn't sneak up on her with the maul. At one point, Suzanne told him that she had to use the bathroom, and Neil walked her at gunpoint upstairs, and in the bathroom she collected her nerves and noticed another rope attached to the inside of the shower to another eye bolt. What this rope was ever used for is unknown. Neil and Suzanne then slept on the mattress together until the next morning when he loaded Suzanne into Holberton's car and drove her to her apartment to let her shower. He then took her to the Bonfire Lounge to get food while she sat there in total shock. They then went and got cigarettes, and Neil bought a tape recorder, and she then told Neil that she didn't want to go back to the townhome and begged him to take her to her place. For whatever reason, Neil relented. With the gun still in his charge and from the apartment of Suzanne, he had Suzanne call Beth Weeks, her roommate, and ask when she would be home. Beth came home into the house and had no idea what she was walking into. Neil started by pointing a gun at Beth Weeks' forehead and asking her if she wanted to die. On Monday, July 6th, he sat both women at the kitchen table and recorded his entire rambling confession over multiple hours, letting the horror of the past week come to light for Suzanne and Beth. For whatever reason, Neil then left the two women alone in the apartment, and they made no attempt to escape or call for help, still believing that he had full control and thinking that he was testing them and watching them if they tried to escape or call the police. During their time alone in the house, Suzanne gathered all the clothing that she had been wearing in the murder room and wrapped it in plastic and put it under some clothing in her closet for police to find later if she was murdered. She and Beth wandered around the apartment like zombies until Neil returned. He called a local reporter and told him that he had a big story for him, and in another bizarre twist, he told the women that they could call over a male companion to make them feel more comfortable. What exactly Neil's plan here was is unknown. They called a man named David Kane, a mutual friend who unwittingly came over. When David Kane entered the apartment, he was met by the gun-toting William Lee Neil. Neil offered him a chance to leave, but said that there would be consequences for the women if he did. Kane could tell that the women needed him, and in an act of heroism, he stayed with them. Neil played him the lengthy confession tape and took them all out to All Stars Strip Club for a night of Neil pretending to have the time of his life. Awkward doesn't even begin to describe how that evening must have been. No member of the party ever attempted to leave, likely fearing for those left behind and unable to orchestrate anything without discussing it in front of Neil. They then went back to Suzanne's apartment and Neil gave them instructions. He said that he was capable of killing more people, but that he was going to return to the townhome to kill himself. He then told Beth to call police, and he said to Suzanne that when he left, he wanted her to give police a note from him. After he left, they called and they were told that they were supposed to wait outside on the lawn for the police, but they feared Neil coming back up and shooting them while they sat on the lawn, so they stayed inside. The police came quickly and their ordeal was finally over. Unknown to Neil, while all of this was going on at Suzanne's apartment, the bodies of the women were already being discovered. After Rebecca Holberton failed to show up at work, a welfare check was done on her home. Deputy Michael Burgess went over to the home and found the windows papered as if someone was painting. He found the door unlocked, and with no answer, he entered the residence and immediately noticed something was wrong. The place was littered with food containers and cigarette butts. The inside looked like a torture chamber, and as he stepped further, he noticed the wrapped body. He exited the townhome and called for backup. Former Chief Deputy District Attorney Mark Potler was leaving the scene of a murder-suicide when he was called to the townhome. It was unlike any crime scene he had ever witnessed. He saw a woman staring with sightless eyes, duct-taped to a chair, with her head in a pool of blood. There was a driver's license on her lap for an Angela fight. Potler found out who the male occupant of the home was as Charles Tingle, another district attorney, and Jose Aceves, a lead investigator, drove to find Suzanne Scott and hear what had occurred. Neil returned pages he was receiving on a payphone by talking to Sheriff Investigator Cheryl Zimmerman, and Neil talked for an hour with her as the others listened. He was up and down, claiming to have killed 500 people and that he would do it again, then asking if he could have a private cell if he surrendered. Neil was then calling from a cell phone, but demanded to have a public attorney present when he surrendered. In a unique move to get Neil into custody without him escaping, Potler messaged his boss, who he was a consultant for, District Attorney Dave Thomas, about posing as a public defender to get Neil into custody. Potler believed he could defend the decision in court under the circumstances, as the rules against deception were not ironclad. Potler was given the go-ahead, and he arranged with Neil to meet him in a department store parking lot. Neil showed up, and a SWAT team swarmed his car and apprehended him without incident. During all this, Holly Walters, the daughter of Candace Walters, was concerned for her mother and knew something was wrong. She had been told by Neil that he had struck a deer while Candace was driving back from Vegas with him and that they were fine, while in actuality her mother was already dead. In a similar story, the mother of Angela Fight and her sister Tara knew something was wrong and knew it for sure when the news started airing the story of the three women's bodies found in a nearby townhome. The families would not hear for far too long that their loved ones were dead. Neil's apprehension and subsequent media coverage played into his deep desires for attention. He made a dramatic public display of firing his attorney at one point and told reporters that there were two other bodies of unknown women that had not been found, which is now thought to be something that he said just to stir the pot. In the coming months, papers and news reports would paint the women that Neil murdered as both gullible and stupid, notions that their families deeply resented, as Neil's ability to con women with lies about what they wanted to hear most, and their trusting nature of a man they didn't immediately dismiss as a liar, was all that stood between them and their gruesome murders at the hands of Neil. The coming months found people coming from the woodwork who knew Neil, including his third wife, who had a remarkably similar story to that of his other wives. She said he was controlling and flashed around money and lied about his employment. When she wanted a divorce, he called police and told them she was suicidal. His ex-wives Karen Wilson and Jennifer Tate said that Neil had attempted to contact them over the years, either in his typical way of calling three times and hanging up, or to talk and beg for money. Investigators found it hard to believe that Neil had suddenly snapped at the age of 42 and decided to go on a killing rampage. He once claimed to have killed 500 people. Was there any truth in these claims that he has other victims? While being held in jail, he was separated from other inmates because they heard what he had done and were not going to refrain. Neil claims they separated him for their benefit because he would have attacked all of them and he would have been unstoppable. Neil was always claiming that he was a lethal, trained killing force, yet his ability to take on multiple inmates is questionable. His constant stream of bullshit reminds me a lot of Leonard Lake and his delusions regarding his own physical abilities and lethal force. Granted, he did prove that he was lethal, but it was only by sneaking up behind unsuspecting women like a coward, so his combat abilities are still in question. Neil reveal both a deep need for control and an unhinged mind that ran in circles around excuses and reasoning. His story was all over the place, stating various reasons for killing the women, and he said that he told Suzanne that she would have to trust him, and that he wanted her to live. He went back and forth on a few points. He said that he wasn't a hitman nor associated with the mob, but he also said that he was genuinely afraid there was a hit out on him. He hinted that he had involvement in the drug trade. He said that he killed Candace and Angie because he found out that they had been snitching, in his words. He was angry that Candace, especially, had dared to ask for any of her money back or threatened to go to the police, and this was why he had urinated on her body, for the ultimate humiliation. He was obsessed with the fear that women were talking about him, in any capacity, behind his back, or that in some way his bullshit was being found out. He also considered himself noble for not involving Angela's children in all of this, and bragged that he had talked Angela into becoming a hitman and joining him in a life of debauchery, a twist that he was very proud of. He also said that he was closer to Rebecca than any of the others, and that he didn't want to talk about her. He said that Candace told him that she had been raped by another man once, and he hated that man, despite having just murdered 3 women and forced another to give him oral sex. He even went as far as to say that he was extra gentle when he sexually assaulted Suzanne Scott, and that he was so gentle with her that he was gentlemanly. He always got choked up about his mother, seeming to fight back tears. Much like Ed Gein, when Neil's mother died, it seemed to change his life completely. He had no doubt that if she were alive, she would have been there by his side through this. She wouldn't have agreed with his actions, but she would have stood by him. He mentioned that he had spent his younger years as a cat burglar stealing jewelry from stores and homes. Neil expressed that he wanted nothing more than a loving relationship, and that he wasn't a womanizer. To him, every woman he had been with had betrayed him in some way. Of course, that betrayal was always something that he had mentally invented or blew completely out of proportion. Every woman was guilty until proven innocent. He said he didn't want women to hurt or suffer, and as if indicating that he was merciful and thoughtful, he told investigators that he wanted to kill the women in a way that would go quickly and not suffer. He picked the mall because it was heavy, and he thought he could kill them instantly with it. He also indicated that he had bashed in the heads of dogs and cats who tried to bite him or that he lost any control of. Interestingly, he had a kitten in the townhome where he killed the women, and the kitten survived its ordeal despite Neil claiming that he had continued killing animals into adulthood because it was easier than killing humans. An investigator asked Neil what he was planning to do with the bodies since they discovered some footlockers and a saw in the home, and he said he would answer after a break, but that tons more women would have been killed if he wasn't stopped. He later admitted that he was going to feed the bodies to carnivores that he had been baiting out in the wild for years to prepare for just this kind of moment. The investigators had to wonder how, and with what, he had supposedly been baiting carnivores with. He seemed to have a lot prepared for a man who had only suddenly decided to go on a murderous rampage. Neil had said that there was a passage in the Bible he thought investigators might want to look up. And he said, "It's about this pale horse, and on it was a rider, and his name was Death. And Hades followed him. That's me, okay? That's me." Neil did a number of things while he was questioned, including praising the work of the police as if he had any kind of authority on it, and complimenting the appearance of the female investigator, Cheryl Zimmerman. He also told investigators that he had been reading many books about Ted Bundy, and that he believed himself to be a lot like Bundy. Like Bundy, he believed that when he killed, the more he practiced the con, you were like an actor or an illusionist, and you sold yourself as somebody to the people you encountered that you weren't. He would carry on the copycat actions of Ted Bundy into a trial where he would insist on defending himself, despite not being a lawyer. The trial for this case was bizarre. Neil defended himself, much to the dismay of the public defender, who believed he would have grounds to appeal the death sentence due to defense of himself. His former counsel agreed that seeking the death penalty on a man without counsel was absurd. Neil was the 6th person in Colorado's history to not have his death sentence decided by a jury, but by a panel of 3 judges from various districts. At first, he wanted death, but later he claimed to have devoted his life to God and wanted to live to serve God. He spent months in the prison library before the trial studying stacks of legal materials. Since he was defending himself, he was also given special phone privileges and used the time to call public defenders and consultants and leave rambling messages on their answering machines. He also used his time to marry yet another woman while in prison, and much like in his past, he tipped his prison barber $14 on a $6 haircut, undoubtedly getting the money from the woman he married. At trial, he didn't cross-examine witnesses or even object to anything the prosecution said. He would just nod in silent agreement at anything a prosecution witness brought up. His only defense was a pastor who testified to Neil's newfound devotion to God. At trial, the coroner stated that, unlike Neil's thought that the women had died quickly, there was evidence that they had lived for minutes after the blows to their heads, putting to rest the notion that Neil had killed them quickly. Suzanne Scott bravely testified and recounted the entire horrific event without breaking down, which was testament to her ability to hold her cool. William Lee Neal was sentenced to death on September 29, 1999. He would be the fifth person in Colorado to be on death row. I'm going to read a passage from the book Love Me to Death by Steve Jackson about Angela's sister Tara's nightmares that she had after her death. That night, Tara had another nightmare. In it, she was awake and listening in the dark to the sound of someone crawling on the ground around her bed. Then she realized that the noises were being made by a skeleton as it crept nearer to her. She could not scream, but only make a strangled murmuring sound. Tara would experience more nightmares, including one in which she woke up screaming during her honeymoon. But there was also one other dream, one that helped her get through the next year. Again, she dreamed that she was lying in bed on her stomach with the covers down, listening to the sound of something crawling towards her. Only this time, the sound was replaced with the feeling of someone blowing gently on her back. Turning over, she found herself looking into the face of Angela. Her sister looked beautiful. Her blue eyes were clear and bright, her cheeks and lips pink. Angela was smiling, and it was then that Tara knew that it was all right to go on with her life. Holly, Candace Walter's daughter, expressed how much her mother loved life, but was done with men, and she wished she had never met William Lee Neal. She lost her best friend. Jennifer Tate said that she wished she could have told everyone that if they ever met a man named William Lee Neal, that they should turn and walk the other direction. So my conclusions on the case of Wild Bill Cody are that Neal talked a lot. In fact, in reading his ramblings, I honestly got kind of bored. He not only repeats himself, but he contradicts himself constantly. And I truly believe it's mostly because, in his effort to control his environment and control what other people thought of him, he never actually developed any of his own opinions. He never developed an ability to feel empathy or connect with others on a level beyond the surface. In the same breath, he'll talk about not wanting to hurt those women and not being a disrespectful man, but then go on to call women sluts and whores who had it coming. He was obsessed with control and obsessed with what he thought other people were saying about him. Women talking about him behind his back or women he thought were loyal to him doing anything behind his back was what he hated the most. He hated the thought that any woman would dare to think little of him or underestimate him. And he had to prove himself otherwise. William Lee Neal never understood what a relationship with a woman was. What a relationship with anyone was, to be honest. His interactions with everyone, especially women, were ones where he was peering down at them as if through a microscope and manipulating their environments to fit whatever depraved mental delusion he had cooked up about their life. To him, women were not their own people with their own desires and their own thoughts. They had no right to ever be angry at him or feel betrayed because to him, he was the only person in the entire world who ever felt those kinds of emotions. But of course, he's completely wrong. We all feel those things. We just grew up, and we learn how to deal with them. He's a lot like a child who is caught doing something wrong and immediately starts to give an excuse-laden apology. Neal has, in his own words, given his life up to God, which isn't shocking to me at all, considering he's always trying to find something to take the burden of his own mistakes off of his own shoulders. He now believes he's at the mercy of God, and at least to me, That's just another way of saying he can't look at himself in the mirror and fully understand the piece of shit he truly is. I think he has mentally escaped the true weight of his actions, and that's a shame. Whatever he has to say at this point is completely meaningless. In 2003, his death sentence was commuted to life in prison, and now he sits in a room, turning food into shit and clutching his Bible, and I think that's exactly what he was always meant to do. So, there's Wild Bill Cody, William Lee Neal. Next week, I'll have a brand new episode all about another historical murder for you guys. And at the end of the month, I'll have another longer episode for you guys. So stay tuned. Check out the Facebook if you want to see any pictures about this case. And please feel free to drop a comment and share the podcast with anyone you know who you think might be interested. Thanks, everybody.